You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The United States is the world's largest jailer, with 2.3 million people behind bars. When journalist, professor, and prison activist Baz Dreisinger began studying the high rates of incarceration in this country, she realized that few attempts are made to rehabilitate prisoners or prepare them for life outside. So she created the Prison to College Pipeline program at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. Then, after years of working in American prisons, Ms. Dreisinger realized that she needed a fresh perspective, so she began traveling around the world to discover how other countries deal with incarceration. Her travels resulted in a book called Incarceration Nations, A Journey to Justice in Prisons Around the World. I spoke with Baz Dreisinger this past March, and we're rebroadcasting that conversation for you now. You were raised in the Bronx during the 80s and 90s, right, and attended CUNY, and you're white. How did you first get interested in African-American studies?
I think that growing up in New York, you're impacted by all kinds of peoples and cultures, and so it was sort of natural to be drawn to that.
And your first book was about the artificial categories of race, the social history of real and fictional white people who passed as black. Is that thinking, to some degree, what got you thinking about prisons as well?
It is. I mean, clearly we know that the criminal justice system negatively impacts certain populations far more than others. So I've long been thinking about issues of race and intersections, especially of culture and crime and justice and arts.
And that's what got you into researching American prisons?
Well, actually, I wasn't doing that much research. I was more volunteering in an educational capacity. I was writing about hip-hop culture and the intersections there with the criminal justice system. And that was when I started getting letters from people in prison inviting me to come give talks.
The hip-hop culture often eulogizes the gangster image, and that is a problem, isn't it?
It is, but it also, hip-hop also critiques the criminal justice system and offers insight into it in all kinds of profound ways.
The statistics you cite in your introduction have become all too familiar. With just 5% of the world's population, we have 25% of the prison population. Should we be surprised that most of them are there for nonviolent crimes?
Well, not most, but many. Yeah. And certainly we have an issue around our treatment of drug offenders in this country, treating it as a criminal justice issue rather than a public health issue, which is what it is. And I'd like to think we're moving more in that direction.
Well, 51% are there for drug offenses and just 1% for homicide, 4% for robberies.
Yes, that's the federal system. In the state system, the statistics are a little different, but they're also quite dramatic.
And in California, 3,700 prisoners are serving 25 years to life in nonviolent offenses. Why such steep penalties? Is that the result of the three strikes laws?
It is. It's the legacy of the three strikes laws. It's also, as I see it, it's a legacy of America's culture of punishment more generally and our fixation on revenge and punishment and harm.
Now, whenever the death penalty comes up, somebody's bound to cite the cost of keeping people in death rows. But America spends more than $50 billion on corrections in general. In the past two decades, money spent on prisons has risen at six times the rate of spending on higher education.
Mm-hmm.
So it costs $88,000 a year to incarcerate a young person, more than eight times the $10,653 to educate him or her. Why has it become so expensive?
Well, we keep adding, longer and longer sentences, for one. So we're keeping people away for a long time. Surveillance devices and security devices. It's sort of an extension of the tough-on-crime approach rather than the smart-on-crime approach.
Your book is about your search for perspective on incarceration. You give some of the American history in your introduction. It might be surprising to some that the whole notion of long-term incarceration is a fairly new concept. How did it develop?
So we prison grew up alongside our democracy in this country. What you had was in the late 18th century, there were all these ideas going around about a new form of dealing with crime in a different way. And instead of harming the body, harming the spirit, harming the person in some way that would be more civilized. And so there were all kinds of theories being developed by philosophers in France and England and other countries. And America, as it was being born, decided to actualize these theories and built what are considered the first two modern prisons in Pennsylvania and in New York. And we were quite proud of these as having enacted something more civilized than our colonizer.
And then what happened?
Well, then what happened is that you had folks from around the world really come to see these models and take them home to their home countries. And so some of the most famous examples of these visitors are Charles Dickens and Alexis de Tocqueville, who wrote about them. But you also had leaders coming from as far away as India to see these models and carry them home.
And then we reversed ourselves. Were the 1970s a key time?
The 1970s was the rise of the drug laws and the drug wars that led us to the point of a bloated prison population. And most criminologists, sociologists trace it all going back to the 70s. Also the implementation of stricter sentencing laws, mandatory minimums, and so on and so forth.
And you're right that long-term incarceration is uniquely American in the sense that we put people in jail for life.
Yes.
I was surprised. I'm always surprised when I read about people who've committed terrible crimes in Europe who wind up spending 25 years of their lives in prison for murder.
Yes, there are about 160,000 people in this country serving life sentences, which is an incredible thing considering that's more than the prison population of many nations.
And is it because the European countries think that by the time somebody is in his 50s or 60s that he's less likely to commit crimes again?
Well, they know that that's a fact, right? Studies have shown this again, that people, they call it aging out of crime. So locking someone up for that extensive period of time isn't really doing anything but wasting money.
And you write that there's evidence that increased incarceration has no relationship to a reduction in crime.
Well, as it's been charted by sociologists and criminologists, there's really no correlation between rising incarceration rates and lower crime rates over
and
the years.
We mentioned the 1970s, a time when people in this city were really frightened by a rising crime rate and often drug-related. Is that related to some degree to the fact that 1.5 million black men are missing from our society now?
Yeah, as the New York Times put it in that article. The drop in New York City's crime rate can be attributed to many things. And among scholars, there's a lot of disagreement about what that is and a lot of confusion. So it's certainly not axiomatic to say that this is a product of the prison system.
My guest is Boz Dreisinger, whose latest book is Incarceration Nations, A Journey to Justice in Prisons Around the World. Do you think people are reevaluating the role of prisons in our society? The situation in Rikers, for example, has called a lot of attention to it in this city, but we've seen it all around the country.
I do think we're hitting a critical mass in terms of folks reconsidering this as an approach to crime and thinking about ways to be smart on crime instead of tough on crime. And this is really especially happening because of economics. States are recognizing that they can't be wasting their budgets on this very ineffective method of dealing with crime.
Has the current attention helped inmates at all? Are things improving in the prisons?
Well,
I mean, we have these situations where we have these private-run prisons where people, family can't even visit. They're charged for telephone calls. And we've heard about a lot of violence in those prisons as well.
Mm-hmm. I think there's some slight improvement being made in terms of drops in numbers, in terms of educational offerings. Obama's experimental Pell Grant initiative to make incarcerated students eligible for financial aid again is a wonderful thing. I think we're seeing pockets of movement and progress, but it's not dramatic as yet.
How long had you been teaching in American prisons when you realized that, in your words, the bizarreness of them had worn off?
It had been about, I had been 7-8 years.
So you began your research in Africa?
I did. I went specifically to Rwanda because I wanted to I wanted to start the conversation with victims instead of quote-unquote offenders, which is how we usually start the conversation. And so I wanted to go to a place that had experienced a mass atrocity and found an alternative way of approaching the victims.
Because after the genocide, they had these special courts that they set up?
Yes.
Based on what South Africa had done earlier.
Yes, actually, it was in many ways based on what Rwanda originally did, how they dealt with crime. Historically, in Africa, these kinds of community courts and community sentencing was how, it, in many parts of Africa, how crime was dealt with.
When killers are allowed to live alongside the families and the communities that they have harmed, what does justice mean?
Well, they're allowed to live alongside them because they're either have made or are making reparations for what they've done.
So by apologizing?
Actually, usually it involved labor or economic payback, some kind of service to the family. So it wasn't just I'm sorry. It was an I'm sorry accompanied by action, which is the critical point here.
Your time in Rwanda brought back memories from your own family's experiences during the Holocaust. What happened there?
So I definitely grew up in the shadow of the Holocaust with a grandfather who lost pretty much his entire family line. And so it was very present in my house growing
up.
Did
he talk about it? Because a lot of the survivors of the Holocaust refused to talk about what happened to them.
There was very little talk of it. And that's why I say it was sort of a specter in the household. I had a great cousin who related the whole history of the family's loss in the Holocaust to me, and that was one time, and it took a specific project to make her do that.
One question comes up over and over. Would you rather be the victim or the offender in the Rwandan genocide? And you ask yourself whether revenge is triumph.
So that's, and that question of would you rather be a victim and offender or an offender is a very impossible question, because you obviously you don't want to be either. And the reason that I ask it is to say it's ultimately unanswerable. But the issue is that there is some honor in being a victim. To be an offender and a truly conscious offender is then to have to wear that for the rest of your life. And not all offenders are conscious offenders, but if you bring them to the point of consciousness, in many ways it produces that kind of a natural justice, because you're the one who has to walk around with this stain on your spirit, knowing that you've committed this wrong.
But some people don't feel that they did anything wrong, even if they did.
I think it's our job as a justice system to bring people to that awareness, and that's what we should be focusing
so
on.
So when you spoke to some of these people in Rwanda, Eric, Kamichi, Noreen, among others, what did they tell you?
I spent a lot of time among victims and trying to understand what it was that brought them healing or didn't bring them healing, or how they dealt with this process of restoration and forgiveness. And many of the people that I spoke to really believed in this idea of reconciliation and restitution, and that this form of justice was better than a revenge-based one. And they recognized that revenge perhaps wouldn't have brought them the same kind of healing that this did.
It would be wonderful if Rwanda had turned out to be an ideal country in the aftermath, but it continues to have all sorts of problems. Related to the genocide, or is it just that the politics have become confused because of a totalitarian kind of government?
Yeah, it's that, and it's also economics. Rwanda doesn't have a tremendously strong economy, and it was relying on lots of foreign aid after the genocide, which is drying up. And so as a result of that, there's all kinds of engagements that are threatening the progress made there.
And you wrote that you felt you were in prison while you were in Rwanda? How so?
Oh, in the sense that there's so many people who committed the act of genocide in this country. So in some ways, I called the country a liquidated prison. And if you weren't in prison, if they weren't in prison, then you were a victim of those who were. So the whole country is this sort of theoretical experiment, in a sense, for thinking about punishment and justice on a very grand scale.
My guest is Boz Dreisinger, associate professor in the English department at John Jay College of Criminal Justice, CUNY, and founder of the and academic director of the Prison to College Pipeline program, which offers credit-bearing college courses and reentry planning to incarcerated men. Her book, Incarceration Nations, A Journey to Justice in Prisons Around the World, is published by Other Press. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with the rebroadcast of a conversation I had with Professor Baz Dreisinger, who's also a journalist, prison activist, and the founder of the Prison to College Pipeline Program at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. I spoke with her in March about her book, Incarceration Nations, A Journey to Justice in Prisons Around the World. And during the conversation, our phone line started to light up with listener questions. One caller inquired about health care in prisons, adding that he felt American prisons are in many cases a stand-in for mental hospitals.
Absolutely, and it's mirrored around the world. There's much of the same problems. The statistics are difficult to come by in many countries, but it's an absolute mirror of our system.
So as we try to be more humane in dealing with the mentally ill, we wind up incarcerating them when they act out?
Well, we're using the prison system as our social welfare system in all kinds of ways, unfortunately.
Another caller, James from the Upper West Side, wonders how you would feel about Nazis not going to prison but being free to live among Holocaust survivors doing community service.
Well, community service is a broad term. I'd want to know exactly what that means and how the process is being run. But I think if it were administered in a kind of real and profound way involving the needs of victims, which is the most important thing here, then I would applaud that.
So you would have thought that sentencing Adolf Eichmann to death was the wrong approach?
Well, Eichmann, as such a significant leader in the movement, as one of the top figures there, I think may be deserving of something otherwise and would be harder to impact with a restorative justice type program.
While you were waiting for your plane at Kigali International Airport in Rwanda, you read Desmond Tutu's No Future Without Forgiveness. And I'll quote a little bit from that. Forgiveness does not mean condoning what has been done. It means taking what happened seriously and not minimizing it, drawing out the sting in the memory that threatens to poison our entire existence. It involves trying to understand perpetrators and so have empathy to try to stand in their shoes and appreciate the sort of pressures and influences that might have conditioned them. Mm. So were you convinced by that?
Absolutely. It's one of my favorite quotes from Tutu and on the subject of forgiveness.
And you write that you left Rwanda believing in a world without prison. So should criminals go unpunished?
Absolutely not. I think they should.
I mean, some people should be kept away from the rest of society.
Yes, there are people like that, and those should be kept away in institutions. But I don't think that reflects the bulk of what we're talking about when we talk about the criminal justice system. The bulk of people in prisons around the world, as I saw it, are people who can be given opportunities and can live in society under the right circumstances.
A listener is wondering about privatization of prisons. Is that happening in other countries or only in the United States?
Yes, it's an American invention that has definitely been exported around the world. And I worked in several private prisons or worked with several private prisons in Australia, but it exists in various parts of Europe as well. There are some very strong companies in the UK.
Your visit in South Africa begins with a trip to the Polismoor Correctional Facility, and there's a sign in front, A Place for New Beginnings.
Yes.
Do they take that seriously?
Hardly.
There had been an escape the day before.
There had been. Polismoor is a notorious prison. It's estimated as the largest prison in Africa, and it's notorious for its gang violence, for its overcrowding. It's at 230% capacity, somewhere thereabouts.
Built for 4,500 prisoners, and it has 10,000 or so.
Yes, and there's a shortage of social workers, there's a shortage of staff, and essentially it's a free-for-all run by the people who live there.
You arrived for Restorative Justice Week. What's that?
Restorative justice is a paradigm that I'm very excited about for thinking about crime and justice in a way that's different from punishment. And it's a victim-centered approach that is more interested in restitution and reparations and acknowledgement of wrong that as opposed to revenge and punishment and harm.
Are there any American prisons that try the restorative justice approach?
Absolutely. It's very present in our system. It's just sort of an ancillary in our system as opposed to the main event.
But there are plenty. I know I'm guaranteed to get mail from listeners who say, why should these people be coddled? We give them gyms. We let them work out and do all sorts of things that, in fact, we give them education that they might not have gotten otherwise.
So there's a lot of answers to that important question. But I think, number one, we have to recognize that many of these people in prisons are people who were not given opportunities in the first place, who were in many respects conditioned for prison cells and jail cells. And so we have to recognize our role in producing these criminals, and by our, I say, society as a whole. And the other thing to consider is that these folks in prisons are going to come home. They're going to return to us as in our society. How do we want them coming back? So those are two really critical things to consider.
Years ago, I had a friend who had spent some time in prison and he'd been trained as a draftsman. But when he came out, he realized that he had been poorly trained as a draftsman and there was no way he could get a job as a draftsman.
We're not doing a good job of preparing people to come home and be productive citizens and achieve success.
In South Africa, you were a part-time facilitator at the Table of Confession. What was that?
The Table of Confession. I love how that sounds. It was part of a restorative justice program that happens in this prison. And as part of that, it involved the incarcerated men in Polesmoor kind of taking responsibility, taking ownership, addressing the ways that they've been harmed and addressing the harms that they've done to others. And so the room was divided up into several different tables that were named for things like forgiveness, confession, all kinds of the process of restorative justice.
And they went to the table that they felt most comfortable going to?
Nope. They were assigned to a table, and I happened to be assigned to confession.
And you heard stories from Jerome, Abraham, and Anthony. How did they end up in prison?
It was versions of the same story, which is that they were from the notorious townships of South Africa. They grew up with nothing. They grew up surrounded by crime and drugs and lack of opportunity. And so they were essentially funneled directly into the prison system.
And part of the restorative justice idea is to own choices. But after you witnessed Cape Town, you became kind of cynical about how much choice some of these prisoners actually had.
Well, I think we always have to balance our belief in the human agency and capacity to do things in the world with a recognition that many people, and specifically certain races of people and certain classes of people, don't have free will, in a sense, because they are from certain communities that are being conditioned for crime.
I'm speaking with Boz Dreisinger, whose book is Incarceration Nations, A Journey to Justice in Prisons Around the World, published by Other Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. What's the racial makeup of Polesmoor Prison?
Polesmoor Prison has, the estimates, again, are not exact, but it's something like 80% black and what's called colored in South Africa.
And are the races segregated?
Not anymore. They were under apartheid, so you still have parts of Polesmoor that have double hallways because whites and blacks were not even permitted to walk along the same hallways under apartheid, and Polesmoor is an older prison.
You say that there's just one social worker at Polesmoor for every 300 prisoners. That seems like a design for failure.
It's absolutely designed for failure. And I had experience working with one of those social workers who was attempting to mediate between one of the men sitting at my table of confession and his mother and sister.
You were a volunteer. Were the other people working at these tables volunteers?
Yes, it's a volunteer run. Many restorative justice programs, not all by any means, but many around the world are run by Christian groups. And so at the head of this was a minister.
You were on sabbatical.
Yes.
So this was eating up a lot of your time.
It was. It was a worthwhile way to spend my sabbatical, very.
Where else did you go?
I spent much of it in Rwanda and South Africa and Uganda. So those three nations.
But then you went to Brazil when your sabbatical was technically over.
Yes. I squeezed in trips wherever I could in order to visit the rest of the countries.
And you visited the Penitenciaria Federal de Candaduras. Forgive me for my bad Portuguese.
Mine isn't much better.
That's Brazil's first federal super maximum prison?
Yes.
Was it like a super maximum prison in the United States?
It was a mirror image of an American supermax. And that's not an accident. It's actually, we've developed this model and exported it to the world.
And you write that Brazil's 550,000 strong prison population is the fastest growing in the Americas. Why? Is because of gang violence? Because of drugs?
Again, lots of reasons, but the war on drugs is what it's often attributed to, and also systemic poverty and inequality, which is what ultimately produces crime in communities.
In these maximum security prisons, solitary confinement is often the norm, and Brazil is using it. It's come under review in the United States, at least for minors in recent years. Is it something that is subject of debate in Brazil?
There isn't as much discussion of it there as here, partly because many people aren't even aware of these federal supermaxes. They're, in a way, hidden from plain sight. They're very far from Rio and other capitals.
Who invented solitary confinement? Is that another American invention?
It is. It's an American invention. It goes back, again, to the 18th and 19th centuries when we had this notion that we should have penitentiaries, penitents. It was almost like creating a monastery. If you isolate people and you give them a Bible, then they will somehow miraculously come about and recognize their wrongs.
Well, the argument for solitary confinement is that often these prisoners are dangerous. You can't allow them to mingle with others, or in some cases they'll proselytize and try to convince others to do the sorts of things that they did, share their criminal knowledge. Is solitary confinement a bad thing, even though some have called it a form of torture?
I certainly think it's a form of torture, and I also cite in the book several studies that show that solitary confinement doesn't actually make prisons safer. And in fact, there are all kinds of other ways of dealing with repeat offenders inside behind bars and creating and actually offering them more control, which enables them to change.
We did a story a while back about somebody who actually tried to get into solitary because he was concerned for his own safety and then discovered that it was driving him crazy.
Right, which is when you're begging to get into solitary, that's a hideous statement about the state of a prison system.
How long do Brazilians allow an inmate to stay in solitary?
Well, this was actually unclear because there are technical rules about it, things that I was told, which is not that long. But in fact, I encountered people in this prison in Brazil who were there for years and in 22 hours a day, solitary, very, very far from families and enduring the torture of that.
Anders Breivik, the extremist who killed 77 people in Norway in 2011, challenged his solitary confinement. A three-room suite with windows, a treadmill, a refrigerator, a DVD player, a Sony PlayStation, a desk with a typewriter, access to long-distance learning, TV, radio, newspapers. Some people might think that's a pretty good thing, and yet he's complaining that it's torture.
Well, he has the right to complain. I think Breivik is one of those glaring examples that we can't build a system on, right? He's somebody who committed a very dramatic, very horrific, very evil act that he's still quite committed to. He came into the courtroom and gave a Nazi salute. So clearly, this is someone who's not, as yet, not being impacted by any kind of correction.
You visited prisons in Uganda, Jamaica, Thailand, Australia, Singapore. Does anyone get it right, as far as you're concerned?
Well, I actually found little moments of getting it right almost everywhere. I'd say Brazil was the exception because of the horror of the supermax. But Norway is often touted as having gotten it right.
And, well, that's where you wind up with a three-room suite if you kill 77 people.
Well, you also end up alone, isolated, and miserable, and potentially, again, not being corrected. And I think Norway, there are no utopias, but certainly Norway's approach is an inspiring one.
In Brazil, one of the people you met, Carlos, is participating in a program called Rehabilitation Through Breeding. Isn't that a good thing?
It is, and that's actually why I went to Brazil, is I had heard about this program where you can lose days of your sentence if you read books and write about them.
But he also suffers from mental illness. Does he get good treatment?
Well, in the prison that I was in Brazil, it was a scenario where pretty much everyone was on medication, but they were on medication after they got to the prison because of the insanity-producing conditions.
So if the next president of the United States decided to name you the advisor on prisons, what would you suggest for American prisons? Or would it have to be done on a state-by-state basis?
Wow. I would love that. I think what I would do is really look at restorative justice models that have worked and find ways to implement them on a grand scale in this country. And also think about alternative to incarceration programs, again, and expanding them. But restorative justice would definitely be at the heart of what I would do.
Human Rights Watch has pushed for the release of prisoners past a certain age because they say, when you're elderly, it's very unlikely, even if you were a violent criminal, that you're going to do anything like that again. People, there's a certain kind of rehabilitation that just simply comes from getting older.
Yes, yes. That's people age out of crime, and it doesn't even take becoming elderly. They talk about this as lower numbers than that.
But the problem is that we have replaced the death penalty with life without parole. So then we would have to change that argument as well.
Well, I do. I actually put life without parole in the same category as the death penalty, and they're part of the same conversation because many people would argue that they'd rather death than a sentence of life without parole.
You talk a lot about the lost talent that you've met in the United States and in your travels, thoughtful, clever, and educated men.
Absolutely.
And I would assume women as well.
Absolutely. I've encountered this in every country I went. I think there's an enormous amount of wasted potential in our prison systems. And we are the ones who are losing here because these are people who could be contributing enormous amounts to society and want to contribute, and we're not giving them the opportunity to do that.
Are men treated better than women in most prisons or vice versa?
In the U.S. or globally?
Well, first the United States.
Well, I think there's a lack of attention to the special needs that women have.
Even though there's a very successful Netflix series.
Yes, indeed, for better and for worse, right. But
you don't think that's accurate?
I think it's certainly not accurate. It's always television, and even the quote-unquote reality shows about prison on television are not accurate. It's all for entertainment purposes, although there are absolutely truths to be found there. But there are lots of things that are not considered as far as women and special needs when we talk about pregnancy, when we talk of shackling during childbirth, all kinds of tremendous issues that need to be addressed.
And we've heard about virginity tests being conducted on women prisoners in Afghanistan.
Wow. Yes. Yes.
Buzz Dreisinger, her book, Incarceration Nations, A Journey to Justice in Prisons Around the World, is published by Other Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you for having me.